Welcome back to The Weekend. I'm Ed Kalenge. My next guest spent 50 years as a foreign correspondent for the Associated Press, The Washington Post, Knight Ridder newspapers, and Time magazine. He exposed that Philippine dictator Ferdinand Marcos and his wife Imelda spent millions of public funds buying up for themselves real estate in America. That garnered him the Pulitzer Prize, truly an example of journalism with purpose. He details his journey in the new book, To Tell the Truth, My Life as a Foreign Correspondent. We say hello to Lewis M. Simons. Lou, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Ed. Nice to be with you.
It is great to have you on. I enjoyed this book tremendously. And Lou, I am convinced that journalists who prefer to work a foreign beat are truly cut from a unique jib. And I got that feeling in previous conversations I had with Marvin Kalb and with Terrence Smith. And I have that feeling about you after reading this book. What is it that sets the foreign correspondent apart from their domestic journalistic brethren?
I wish I could answer that. I can only speak about my own case, of course. I think, as in any profession, any occupation, everybody's got a somewhat different story. I did not set out as a young person to become a foreign correspondent. Frankly, I didn't set out to be a journalist at all. I had a rather conventional upbringing in your state of New Jersey, and something as exotic as being a foreign correspondent came to me considerably later in my life. But once I was exposed to it, I began in covering the Vietnam War in 1967 for the AP. Once I was exposed to it, I realized that there were advantages granted the foreign correspondent that no journalist in the home office or in the newsroom covering conventional beats would have. And principally, what I'm talking about is freedom. Freedom to choose one's own stories, freedom to travel, freedom to cover things that appealed to me as an individual. And the reason I think that the correspondent thousands of miles from home can get away with that is because he or she quickly becomes the expert. The editor back home, the foreign editor, may have a general idea of the country or countries that his correspondents are covering, but doesn't really get into it. So I found myself being able to say, if I were based, for example, in Kuala Lumpur, as I was after Vietnam, saying to my editor, well, I'd like to go to Indonesia next week, and I want to cover a couple of stories on poverty. I want to cover what the middle class in Indonesia is beginning to look like, that sort of thing. My editor would say, well, go ahead. You know, it sounds like a good idea to me, without really knowing what I was going to deliver. So that I think that's a long way around of explaining to you the appeal.
I think that freedom is absolutely wonderful, especially as a journalist. And as you mentioned, you got your start working for the AP. You're 26 years old in 1967, and you're working Vietnam. You're covering it for the AP. Lou, at 26, many young print journalists, they're still cutting their teeth writing obits and editing classified ads pertaining to the sale of bald snow tires. But at 26, you are right there in what was the journalistic stage internationally of that time. How much did that accelerate your career and accelerate your experience in what it is that you did?
Oh, I think it meant pretty much everything. You didn't point out, and I insist that you do, that my wife was with me. She, too, was a journalist working for CBS Television at the time that I was with AP. And I was 26, she was 23, even younger than I. First of all, I think that you have to bear in mind that covering war is a young person's game. Particularly at the time of Vietnam, when we as correspondents had the full cooperation of the U.S. Military and even pretty good cooperation from the South Vietnamese military, there was a lot of physical stress and strain involved in getting out day after day, covering battles, marching with the troops, that kind of thing. And there were people in their 40s and 50s who, a handful of them, who were doing the same thing. And I used to wonder about that. How could they possibly keep up? And would I want to be doing the same thing when I was 40 or 50? As it turned out, I was, but I didn't know that at the time. Did it forward my career? Yes, it did, mm-hmm. in the sense that by the time I finished my 13 months in Vietnam, I knew I wanted to be a foreign correspondent. Had I decided that this was not for me and I wanted to go back to, say, to New York or to Washington and to cover major U.S. politics, it would have been a different story. I don't think that my time in Vietnam would have stood me in much stead under those circumstances, but because I wanted to stay abroad, it paid off.
And staying abroad for you meant spending decades covering Asia. Lou, why was covering Asia so important to you, and what made it so attractive journalistically to you?
I quickly fell in love with it. The whole place, not just Vietnam, but country after country that I went to and visited or was based in, just each one fascinated me more than the other. And I never regretted not expanding my purview out back to Africa or Europe. I did spend some time over the years in the Middle East and even a bit of time in the former Soviet Union and Central America, but overwhelmingly my career was in Vietnam and in Asia, mm-hmm. and I loved every bit of it.
As your career moves along, you get to the point when you write a 3-day series on the hidden wealth of Ferdinand and Imelda Marcos, which wins the Pulitzer Prize. Lou, how difficult was it to uncover that story? How long did it take to flesh that story out? And were you surprised about the impact that story ended up having?
Good questions. I won that Pulitzer with two of my colleagues, mm-hmm. From the San Jose Mercury News, which was a Knight Ridder newspaper in California. Mm-hmm. And there was no way that I, based as I was in Asia at the time, I was actually, my home base was in Tokyo, there was no way that I could have done that without my two colleagues, Catherine Ellison and Pete Carey. But having said that, the investigation lasted 18 months. And I'm not sure how many newspapers nowadays would take the chance and invest the money and time on three reporters for 18 months, not knowing until quite far along that this was going to pay off, that there would actually be a story that could be published. What happened was that I began moving my coverage from my Tokyo base to Manila, to the Philippines, in 1985, after the assassination of Ferdinand Marcos's chief political rival, a man named Ninoy Aquino. Mm-hmm. He was assassinated the day he returned from exile in the United States, right at the airport. That drew me back to the Philippines, and I began spending more time there than anywhere else in Asia. And as I moved along, I began hearing rumors. Filipinos are wonderful rumor mongers and love to chat and exchange gossip. And I began amassing a long list of what were purported to be properties, expensive properties bought by Imelda and Ferdinand and their so-called cronies in Manhattan, on the West Coast, elsewhere in the United States, around the Caribbean, Australia, massive purchases. And, you know, one begins to wonder, well, we know what he's paid as president. It ain't much. And how can they possibly do this? So this led me into a practice among wealthy Filipinos, and particularly powerful political Filipinos, called dollar salting, where they were taking hard currency out of the Philippine treasury and moving it surreptitiously abroad, whether through third countries or through Chinese interlopers. There was a whole variety of methods that they used. And then they invested this money in top-of-the-line real estate. The most famous piece was a building in Manhattan that is still a landmark. So having gathered this information over a period of months, I put it all together in a very, very lengthy menu, which I memo, which I sent to my editor in San Jose, Jonathan Krim was his name, and I said, look, I can't prove any of this, but it's so widely spread and believed that there's got to be something to it. And John passed the memo on to Pete Carey, who was one of the early users of the internet for investigative journalism purposes, and he began getting into documentation in New York and elsewhere. And between Pete working in the U.S., me working in the Philippines, and then bringing on Kathy Ellison to knock on doors in the San Francisco Bay Area, we put together this 3-day series that absolutely and positively nailed down all of these properties and the movement of several billion dollars out of the Philippine Treasury illegally. That story set off an explosion, I would say, in the public in the Philippines, because the Philippine press itself was under censorship at the time, and could never do this kind of work. So the political opposition to Marcos jumped on it. They had the whole series reprinted in half a dozen different Philippine dialects and languages, spread it around the country, even dropping it out of helicopters and small planes. And there's no question whatsoever that it led directly to force Marcos into holding elections, which he lost, and the result was that Ninoy Aquino, the man who had been murdered, his widow, Corazon Cory Aquino, was elected and became president of the Philippines.
And Lou, what I find fascinating about that story, and I can remember at that time, how that story kind of leapt from traditional news coverage, and here at home, it landed within our collective pop culture. That story truly resonated for some reason. You remember the countless references to Imelda Marcos, the amount of shoes she had. It was a part of Johnny Carson's monologue at night. But there was something intrinsic about that story, about the corruption, about the excess within that, that truly resonated with people here at home. Why do you think that was?
Well, you mentioned the shoes. I mean, frankly speaking, I'm not particularly proud of it, but the fact of the matter is that after 18 months of investigating and all our hard work and putting together this explosive investigative series, if you ask any American today, I'm going to give you a name, tell me the first thing that comes to your mind. You say Imelda Marcos, they're going to say shoes. So that's the way it goes. But I think that by that time, Americans who might normally not be interested in the Philippines had caught on to the Aquino assassination. After all, you've got to bear in mind that the Philippines was for a century the United States' only real colony ever to be held anywhere in the world.
True.
I mean, so some people think that Cuba was a U.S. colony, mm-hmm. Or Puerto Rico, but they were not. I mean, legalistically, they were not. But the Philippines was a U.S. colony, so there was a lot of connection. U.S. troops for decades had been based in and around Manila. There were lots of Filipinos in the U.S. Navy. There were lots of Filipino immigrants in the Bay Area and in other major cities of the United States. So there was that connection. Furthermore, the Marcoses, Imelda and Ferdinand Marcos, were close personal friends of President Reagan and Nancy Reagan, his wife.
Mm-hmm.
And Reagan, of course, was president at the time we're talking about. So papers began going back into their archives and pulling out pictures of Ronnie and Imelda dancing in Manila and, you know, that kind of thing. So it was in the public consciousness. And as I say, unfortunately, or maybe not necessarily, but the fact is that the shoes remain our greatest legacy.
they certainly do. You were very open in this book to tell the truth. There are countless stories. Some are very poignant. There are funny moments. There are tender moments. You talk about your family. Lou, are you surprised how open you are in this book about both yourself and your immediate world around you? When you look back at this book now with the finished product, does it surprise you in any way?
Yeah, that's really an insightful question, and thank you for asking it. I'm a journalist who, having begun my career more than 50 years ago, was trained both at Columbia Graduate School of Journalism and at the Associated Press in old style, now very quaint journalism, which is to say, nobody gives a damn what you think. I had an editor tell me that once in no uncertain terms. Nobody gives a damn what you think. So keep your own prejudices, your own feelings, your own interpretations out of the copy. Report the facts, and that's that. I don't necessarily defend that the way I used to, but I think we've gone far too far away from that in recent years, particularly in the years since the Donald Trump presidency. Mm-hmm. But as far as my being open, it might be worth my mentioning that I began this project, this book, without having any intention of publishing it. I was writing it. Yeah, it's really true. I began it about, now time flies, but close to 4 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
For my children, I have three children. All three of them were born somewhere in Asia. I have, at the moment, seven with one more on the way, six with one more on the way, grandchildren. And I realized that my own kids, even though they were all, as I say, born in Asia, lived there at least through high school, that they had a very different sense of what Daddy did for a living, and that than I had myself and that my wife had, and they didn't really understand our motivations and what drove us and so forth. So that's how I started out. Then came COVID, and for the greater part of 3 years, I had nowhere to go, nothing to do except sit at my computer and write this thing. And I began realizing that there was more here, that I really did have an unusual life in the general scheme of things, having lived abroad for 50 years, having seen some of the worst of humanity and hopefully a little bit of the best, and cruelty and lack of justice that needed to be told in a way that moved far beyond, as I say, my old journalistic teachings of nobody gives a damn what you think. And that is the result of the book. I mean, the book is the result of that kind of thinking. I I definitely decided early on in that process that I could not be less than candid in talking about who I was, where I came from, what motivated me. And so I pulled out the stops. I wouldn't say I pulled out all stops, but I didn't discuss some of the more intimate elements of my life, because I think that's really nobody else's business.
Sure.
But I did go beyond, far beyond my normal journalistic practice.
Well, you're the perfect person to have a conversation with, if we can divert for just a moment, about modern journalism, because you are from that old school, and you come from a time when journalists were allowed to practice their craft and they had resources backing them up. You mentioned earlier, you talked to your editor, you know what, I want to go to Indonesia and I want to examine the middle class there. Okay, Lou, we'll send you the plane ticket, off you go. Now, every single day, you tend to hear about journalistic cutbacks and layoffs here and layoffs there, and budgets are shrinking. And what we know as media and news media is changing dramatically. Lou, we seem to be surrounded by self-media. And what I mean by self-media is that anyone with a smartphone can call themselves a journalist, and anyone who spends $50 a month to keep a website active can call themselves a news organization. Thus, that allows for anyone to shop around for the news that may not inform them or educate them, but satisfy them. And I find that to be kind of dangerous in a way. It's like we're telling the news consumer you can avoid the castor oil and instead go right to the Hershey bar. Am I wrong about that?
Yuck. No, you're not wrong about it. You're absolutely right. And I've been thinking a great deal about that the last couple of days. I'm in Washington, D.C., and the Washington Post just announced yesterday to its staff that there were going to be major cutbacks in the newsroom. And this is not the first time it's happened, but it's worth looking at the Post for a moment before I go on to the rest of your question. The Post was, like most newspapers in the country, going through a terrible time 5-6 years ago. That recently, they were losing readers, they were losing subscribers, they were losing advertisers for the reasons that you've already mentioned. Basically, online news within quotes. And then along came a white knight with the deepest pockets in the world, Jeff Bezos of Amazon, who bought the Washington Post and was seen, I think, really by just about everybody on the staff and everybody who was interested in real news as a savior. And I've been watching the Post. I still get it both on. I get the hard copy of the newspaper delivered to my door every morning, as well as watching it online. And I've been impressed, at times awed, by some of the investigative work that they've done, a whole variety of stories that the Post has done of late, that very, very impressive. And now here comes word delivered by the publisher that those happy days are gone. And why are they gone? Because we're not delivering what the reader wants. Now that is dangerous. Why is that dangerous? Okay, when I was in the newsroom at the Post just before going overseas, the Post ran a survey of its readers and asked them to list in numerical order the kinds of news that meant the most to them, whether it was national politics or economic or sports. Anyway, foreign news, to which I was about to devote the next 50 years of my life, foreign news ended up just behind the comics. If the Post at that time were to make the decision, well, we should spend our money and our resources giving the reader what they wanted, they would have dropped me like a hot potato. They would have closed down all of their foreign bureaus and expanded the funny pages.
Yep.
Thank God they didn't do that. But it's beginning to sound like that all over again. And this is a terrible thing. Look, I appreciate everything that the internet has made available to us. I appreciate what social media are doing. I appreciate the ability of every person with a phone to be a reporter and a photographer, because it pays off often. I mean, all you have to do is look at one of the cable news programs, and you see how much that you see on the screen, particularly from places like war fronts in Ukraine, that those sort of narrow pictures,
true,
you know, where the two sides are black,
yep,
those are coming off of somebody's cell phone.
That's right, yep.
So you're getting stuff that no one or two or six reporters and photographers could do. And that's great. But the fact remains that the people taking those photos, people writing those quick hits on online, on social media, we don't know who they are. We don't know what their motivation is. We don't know what their biases are. And are we getting straight stuff? Well, then, you know, the opposition will say, well, how do I know who you are, Simons? How do I know what your biases mm-hmm. are? How do I know what's motivating you to cover this story and not that story? Fair enough. But the fact is that I was trained at one of the finest institutions of journalistic education at Columbia, that I have spent 50 years working for legitimate news organizations who have professional editors who spend and fact checkers who spend their days and nights going through everything that comes across their desk and doing their best to get it out there as honestly and as forthrightly as possible. Do they make mistakes? Do I make mistakes? Have I made mistakes that I regret? Yes, of course. I'm only human, and so are my editors. But we do a much more reliable job than is by and large available to society without us. If we disappear, we're in trouble. The
right.
country is in big, big trouble.
Lewis, if there is one thing that the reader takes with them after reading this book, To Tell the Truth, what do you hope that will be?
Well, I hope I hope they'll have enjoyed it and appreciated the effort that went into it. But I really hope that this awakens some people who have not yet seen the light to the fact that American journalism, the free press, is in very, very dire straits, in very serious trouble. And the press is such a direct component of our democracy, of American democracy, that if the press trembles, crumbles, and falls to the ground, America will be directly behind it. You cannot have a true democratic republic like the United States, like the great experiment that we have been living through here for a couple of centuries, without a free press and all that the free press represents. You will be left with an ignorant and uninformed, biased, reactionary public that is in no way prepared to run and have run for it by elected officials a legitimate democratic form of government. That's what I want people to take away from my book.
Well, it couldn't be said any better than that. Once again, this book is as enjoyable as it is interesting, To Tell the Truth, My Life as a Foreign Correspondent, published by Roman and Littlefield. It is available now. Lewis Simons, I have enjoyed this immensely. Thank you so much for joining me here on The Weekend.
Thank you, Ed. I've enjoyed it as much as you.
Stay with us. More to come. I'm Ed Kalenge, and this is The Weekend.